Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The driving boom is over. That's according to a new report from the U.S. PIRG Education Fund. The average number of miles driven in the U.S. is heading into its eighth year of decline. And the report found that thanks to the millennial generation, that slowdown is likely to continue for decades. It found that 16 to 34-year-olds drove a whopping 23% fewer miles on average in 2009 than in 2001, the greatest decline in driving of any age group. And in addition, millennials are more likely to want to live in urban and walkable neighborhoods and are more open to non-driving forms of transportation than the older generation of Americans. They're just no longer in love with the car like their parents and grandparents were. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about our society's changing relationship with the automobile. What explains these changes? And what does this mean for the future of transportation policy? Why is it that the U.S. budget allocates just 3% for transportation and roads, and most of that goes to highways? And what drives your relationship with cars? How has it changed over the years? Today, we're joined by Phineas Baxendall. He directs the transportation program for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or U.S. PIRG. He's conducted a number of reports on driving and public transit, including their new report, Reduction in Driving Likely to Continue. And he says the driving boom is over. And he joins us from Boston. Hi, Phineas. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Micheline Maynard. She's editor of Curbing Cars. This is a new journalism project looking at changing attitudes toward personal transportation. They focus on bike sharing, car sharing, public transit, and the future of the automobile. Micheline goes by Mickey, and she's a lecturer at the University of Michigan and spent 6 years on the staff at the New York Times. And Mickey joins us from Ann Arbor. Hi, Mickey. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. And we're joined by Noah Nelson. He's technology and entertainment reporter for Youth Radio's TurnstileNews.com and a contributor to NPR. He recently reported for the NPR series, Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. And he joins us from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Hi, Noah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. And it was a great series. It got a lot of attention.
Oh, yes. Lots of comments.
Yeah, lots of comments. So before we dive in and talk about those comments, Phineas, tell us a little bit about this report, because you make a pretty big statement here that the driving boom is over. And a lot of people might be saying, really? Because we sure see a lot of cars on the roads.
Well, the driving boom being over doesn't mean that suddenly people are going to stop driving. Driving is going to be at the center of how we get around for quite a long time. But what has changed is something which happened pretty much every year for about 60 years in a row. There aren't many things you can say that about, but just about every single year after World War II, the amount of driving increased, both as a total level and on a per-person basis. It used to be that every year, even just per person, driving would increase about 5%, and you know, even on top of population. And that was quite steady, and it kind of trailed off, and there are a bunch of reasons why that trailed off, things like there's just so much saturation you could have of how many cars people could have, how much they could be driving. You know, women entered the labor force, a bunch of things which were behind the additional commuting, which saturated. But then something seemed to have changed, and it didn't just stop with people no longer increasing their driving so much. The number of driving miles actually started to reduce and has fallen now for eight years in a row. And that's a really epic shifting, kind of unprecedented thing, which is something we should take notice of as we plan our future infrastructure and no longer just assume that we're going to need to be planning for more and more highways and wider highways. We should be looking to other forms of transportation.
Right, and we'll definitely talk about the budget, because it's amazing when you look at the chart of where our tax dollars go. It's only 3 cents, and that's everything from public transit to highways. And so we'll definitely talk about that because it's so connected. But first off, I mean, what it really explains this? You say it's thanks to the millennial generation. Young people just aren't in love with cars like their parents and their grandparents. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's most pronounced among millennials, and the evidence on this, unfortunately, is somewhat spotty, but what we do have is quite clear, which is from the beginning and the end of last decade, you know, Americans in general reduced their driving some, but millennials, those born between 1983 and 2000, they reduced their driving miles by 23%, almost a quarter less driving by younger people. And one reason may be cultural. I mean, it does seem to be that younger people just don't relate to their cars in quite the obsessive way that certainly the baby boomers did. But it may also have to do with technology, that people, when they're connecting with and their kind of status symbols, are more about their smartphones and other kinds of gadgets. And that's, you know, how people, if they're going to go shopping, they may order something online rather than go to the mall. And those kinds of technology trends and that kind of connectedness is also most focused around millennials. I will say that it's particularly important that this trend is focused on millennials. We should care most about what millennials want and are doing when it comes to transportation. It's not like millennials' preferences around something like what they think about what kinds of false teeth there should be. Transportation is something where what gets built now is going to mainly be used by today's youth. You know, if we decide to build a new highway or build a new light rail system, it's not going to be people my age, almost 50, who are going to use it mainly. It's going to be younger people, and it's going to be those younger people who are going to mainly end up paying for it. So we should have their preferences at the center when we think about this.
And that's Phineas Baxendall. He directs the transportation program for U.S. PIRG. They just came out with this study that found that the driving boom is over, especially when you look at the millennial generation. And Noah Nelson, you worked on NPR's series Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. So what did you hear from young people about their relationship to cars?
Well, I think part of it depends on where the young people are, right? So in urban areas, I talked to some folks in Los Angeles, and you'd think that with L.A., that's the one city in America you absolutely have to have a car, but it's just not true anymore. They've been working in the public transportation system long enough, and kind of a combination of not having money and not wanting the hassle of having to deal with all the infrastructure that a car involves means that, you know, they're relying on other forms. They're relying on public transportation. They're relying on these car sharing services. But I know that I see it in suburban areas. You know, I have a cousin in Orange County, and he took a little offense at the piece we wrote and said, like, hey, you know, I really want a car. Because for him, a car still means freedom because he's in a really exploded area. I mean, if you're living out in Orange County and you don't have a car, you're functionally stranded. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a play between urban and suburban areas. That's a huge difference there.
Right, or the coast in the middle of the country, because I remember going to Oklahoma City. I mean, they barely have sidewalks to walk on, let alone public transportation. So what about, you know, places in the middle of the country?
Well, and if you look at the comments, which, you know, if that's your bag, go for it. You can see that there's a lot of people, you know, in the middle of the country. They're like, well, you're crazy because you are out on the coasts. And and it's true, you know, like, you know, in places where there hasn't been as much infrastructure built out or the density just isn't what it is in the big urban centers, a car is something you still need unless you have a very, very forward-thinking urban planning. And that's just something we haven't been doing, you know, pretty much since I was born.
Right. Well, and then, Mickey, what does the research tell us about, you know, what would happen if there was an amazing public transportation system in Los Angeles or even Oklahoma City, for example?
Well, since I live in the middle of the country, let me correct some of your misperceptions about being on the coast. First of all, a number of college towns, more than 30 across the country, have bike sharing programs. And the University of Dayton just started a program where they're giving bikes away to freshmen who come to campus and leave their cars at home. Here in Ann Arbor, where I am, we're about to start bike sharing. Columbus is about to start bike sharing. Many college cities in particular have active transportation systems. So what I've found is that there's as much interest in this in the middle of the country as there is on both coasts. And I wouldn't want anyone in your listening audience to get the misperception that no one here is interested in that.
No, yeah, that wasn't what we were trying to say. It was just, it's really hard to take part in public transportation in a lot of places because it's just not there.
Well,
and I'll say, having been to Austin,
places,
Austin's amazing.
If I could just finish, let me just make the point that Chicago just got a bike sharing program. We have streetcar programs starting up in all parts of the country, including Minneapolis. So this is really a nationwide movement. Now, granted, if you live in North Dakota on a farm, you are probably not going to be using public transportation, but there are at least 60 cities around the country, large and small, where there has been a shift away from single use of cars towards more public transit use.
And you wanted to jump in, Noah?
Oh, and I was just backing you up there. Like, I got to go to Austin this year, and I could easily imagine living carless in Austin because they have these beautiful bike lanes and a really good public transportation system, and it is a college town.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so, Mickey, what in terms of changing attitudes, what are you hearing from young people? And again, the millennials, we're talking about 16 to 34-year-olds.
Right. So the students that I teach at the University of Michigan, they're a mix of people. Some folks are getting by with a bike, with a skateboard. Some people are using public transit because we have public transit here. Some people own cars. But one of the things that I'm seeing among millennials is the whole issue of just getting your driver's license to begin with. Because if you look across the country, and I'm sure that there's lots of data on this, many, many states have tightened the restrictions for getting driver's licenses. So there's only about 28% of people who are 16 and now get a license. And even by the time they are 19 and getting jobs or going to college, it's fewer than three quarters who actually have a driver's license. So that's one of the first things that's basically dampened the interest of millennials in getting into cars. They're not getting into cars because they legally aren't able to drive cars.
And in terms of the reasoning for this, I mean, what are the factors? Do they talk about the environmental impacts or, you know, what are you hearing from them?
Well, first of all, it's the economy. Mm-hmm. If you look at new cars, the average cost of a new car is purchase price of a new car is now $31,000. If you talk to kids who have student loans, the average student loan debt is $27,000. So you're basically paying for a car when you're paying off your student loan debt. So, you know, if you took on both a car and student loan debt, in some parts of the country, you can buy a house for that.
Right.
A little mortgage, maybe not San Francisco, but it sure is in smaller places. So you have people graduating who have to move back home because they don't have jobs, or the jobs that they can get are not the jobs that maybe their parents were able to get upon graduation. So cost is definitely a thing. And then the other thing is definitely the psychological, the psychographic changes. Because someone told me that to get away from their parents, they used to have to borrow the car keys and physically get in the car. But now you can just grab your mobile device, put on your headphones, text with your friends, Skype or FaceTime with your friends, and you've gotten away from your parents. There isn't the physical need to actually get together with somebody when you can get in touch with them 24 hours a day.
That is Mickey Maynard. She's editor of Curbing Cars, a new journalism project looking at changing attitudes toward personal transportation in our daily lives. She's also a lecturer at the University of Michigan and talks to students on a regular basis about these issues. Phineas Baxendahl directs the transportation program for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or USPIRG. They're out with a new report that looks at changing attitudes toward driving, and they say the driving boom is over. The average number of miles driven in the U.S. is heading into its eighth year of decline. And according to this report, the slowdown will continue for decades to come. And Noah Nelson is the technology and entertainment reporter for Youth Radio's TurnstileNews.com and a contributor to NPR. You probably heard his series, Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. You can also find it on our website, yourcallradio.org. So what do you think about this? What explains these changes? If your attitude towards driving has changed over the years, we'd love to hear from you. These studies show that people aged 16 to 34 are driving a lot less. Are you one of them? And if so, why? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And then the larger question, what does this mean for the future of our transportation policy? At this point, we've only got 3% of the budget going toward everything from public transit and highways. So what will it take to change that percentage and our priorities when it comes to public transportation? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So Phineas, what does this mean for the future of transportation policy? Is this something that politicians are really looking at? I mean, in San Francisco, it's exciting because the bike sharing program rolls out on Thursday, and then there's going to be an electric bike sharing program in Berkeley and San Francisco next year.
Yeah, it has really profound implications for the way we make policy, in that our transportation planning and our policy making is so focused around accommodating ever-growing driving that it seems like that no longer has to be the focus. That's an enormous opportunity. I mean, there's even without enlarging the transportation funding pie itself, there's a great opportunity to focus more money on these expanding modes of transportation like public transit and biking infrastructure if you're not wasting all this money building new and wider highways that you don't need to build.
Out of that 3%, do we know how much goes toward public transportation and making cities more walkable?
Well, so it's federally, it's about 80% goes to goes to highways, and in most states it's actually more highway focused. In California, I bet it's a little less highway focused.
And when you talk to young people, what is it they want? What kind of changes do they want to see?
Well, people sort of feel, when I've talked to people, some sense of outrage that it's, you know, folks from a generation or two ahead of them who are pretty out of touch with what their, you know, what their aspirations are and seem to, you know, be making decisions for them. I mean, my teenagers, the last thing they want is when someone's making decisions for them. And this is something where really it's them who are most at stake. I wonder if I can just touch on one issue about the economy, and certainly the economy is really important for this issue, but I think it's possible to overstate that it's not just the economy, that this trend started happening years before the recession. If you look only at employed youth, you find also a really steep drop in how many driving miles. There's the economy is part of this, but it's more of an accelerant than the kind of heart of the matter here.
And Noah, before we get to calls, what did you hear from young people about the changes they'd like to see?
I mean, they want better access. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing in terms of those who are already using the public transportation and shared biking. The funny thing is, Sonari Glinton, who's another NPR reporter, and he went out to Modesto, you know, which is where American Graffiti was based. That was sort of the whole inspiration for the story. And he found that for teenagers and college-age kids in Modesto, the car culture is dead. They're getting shipped around by their parents. So they're completely focused on their phones and connecting that way. And I think what we're seeing in terms of the cultural shift is there's even a level where the infrastructure isn't coming into mind because the thing that cars did, which was connect people with each other, has been superseded by an entirely different kind of technology.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Lynn in Danville. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and one of the trends that seems to be growing is the idea of wheels on demand, particularly in San Francisco, where the idea of owning a car, paying for a car, insuring a car, parking a car, repairing a car, really cuts into people's lifestyles. And when they need a car, they can either use an app on their phone or they can make a phone call to, you know, have a car show up. And maybe they only need a car for an hour. So one car could be shared by anywhere from 6 to 12 people in a day. And I see there are more and more companies in San Francisco and the Bay Area as a whole spreading out and fanning out from San Francisco that are offering these types of services for Wheels on Demand.
Right.
And I just would like to know your thoughts on that and what kind of studies are done, and is that a trend that is being seen elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I actually, when I said the bike sharing program kicks off in San Francisco, I forgot to mention that it's kicking off also in Redwood City, San Jose, Mountain View, and Palo Alto. So this is actually a massive program. 700 bikes will be available for rent 24 hours a day at a number of kiosks in these areas. And we'll put a link on our website so you can find out where you can find these bikes. Noah, what are your thoughts on these bike sharing programs, and how often are they used by young people?
Well, actually, I mean, if we could roll back to Lynn talking about the car sharing programs for a second, because I did have a thought there, because bike sharing, you know, I'm based out here in Los Angeles, and we have not kicked off bike sharing yet. But I do see that in New York, it seems to be doing fairly well. But a lot of the complaints are, you know, you will get the bike into the designated spot to drive the bike off, and it'll all be booked up. So there's a lot of kinks to be worked out of those systems in large urban environments. But if you're here in LA for more than 10 minutes, you will see so many Lyft mustaches on cars all over the place. And what I find interesting is that there's a lot of, and this is partly anecdotal, I see a lot of millennials trying to drive for them as a supplemental form of income. And there's this whole layer of economy going on there, which is really interesting to me.
Interesting. What is the cab situation like in LA? Because I've taken a couple cabs here in San Francisco, and they say that these ride-sharing programs are just killing them. I mean, they're averaging $8 to $10 an hour now because of these ride-sharing programs.
Oh, it's a massive fight. I mean, and I used to be a valet parker in San Francisco, and I remember the battle was always between the black cars and the cabs. Those guys hated each other, and this is just another layer of that.
Yeah.
It's difficult, and I think that some people, particularly on the tech side, are really like, "Oh, hey, let's just disrupt this, you know, old model business." But there are reasons why cabs are really regulated, and it has to do with safety and knowing, you know, that someone's going to be held accountable. I mean, I don't trust the Lyft stuff so much.
Well, we're definitely going to have to do a show about this, because this is every cab driver is talking about this issue. And I'm sorry, Lynn, I thought you were talking about bike sharing, but you were talking about car sharing. So, Noah, what would you like, or I'm sorry, Phineas, what would you like to add about car sharing and how popular that's becoming?
Well, it certainly is growing and growing fast. What I think is hard to understand, and it was only when I looked at this more that it became evident. When I first thought about car sharing, I thought, well, why does this matter if somebody's driving a car that they, you know, rent by the hour, or whether they have paid for fully that's sitting in their garage? And then when you think of it, though, in terms of how people make their decisions about the relative costs of whether they're going to bike or drive or walk or take public transit, people, and this is a kind of fundamental principle of economics, is that people base those decisions on those marginal costs, the extra cost of taking a trip. So when you buy a car and you've insured it and it's sitting in your garage, you've taken all of those costs off of the table when you make the decision. It's like you've done an enormous subsidy for driving by having already bought the car. At that point, you might as well use the car because you've already paid all of your costs for it. Whereas if you have to pay those costs as part of your share or part of the costs that you give to your Lyft driver or something of that sort, then you're paying, you know, those are all marginal costs, the kind of, they're brought into the decision for any particular trip.
And we're going to hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today on Your Call, we are talking about changing attitudes in driving. According to a new U.S. PIRG study, the driving boom is over. So what does this say for the future of policy and transportation? We'll be back after this.
1, 2, 3, 4.
KALW's Your Call. To join in today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. If you would prefer to write than to call, The email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. We've done a couple shows about this, and tomorrow we're going to focus on what racial justice means today. Tens of thousands of non-blacks joined 200,000 African Americans on that day in Washington, D.C. So how did white allies who marched understand their stake in the civil rights movement? And with such a change in demographics in the U.S., how has the anti-racist movement evolved? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about Fukushima. There's so much going on there. We know that radioactive water is seeping into the Pacific Ocean and into the water table surrounding the nuclear power plant that was damaged in 2011. So where are we today? What changes have we seen? And what's really happening there? That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about changing attitudes toward driving. A new study from U.S. PIRG found that the driving boom is over. 16 to 34-year-olds drove a whopping 23% fewer miles on average in 2009 than in 2001. It's the greatest decline in driving of any age group. So why the changes? If you're in this category, we'd love to hear from you. Are you driving less? And if so, why? What changes would you like to see when it comes to policy? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Are you taking advantage of the car sharing programs when you can rent a car for a couple of hours? Are you going to take advantage of the bike sharing program that's kicking off on Thursday? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We're joined today by Phineas Baxendall. He directs the transportation program for U.S. PIRG. Micheline Maynard, who goes by Mickey, is the editor of Curbing Cars, a new journalism project looking at changing attitudes toward personal transportation. And Noah Nelson is a tech and entertainment reporter for Youth Radio's TurnstileNews.com. He recently reported for the NPR series Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. And so we talked about car sharing when you can actually rent a car. But what about ride sharing? Mickey, do you see an increase in that?
Yes, absolutely. So as your caller was mentioning, the whole idea of ride sharing is really an outgrowth of apps. We had a little bit of ride sharing before we had mobile devices with apps, but really this is causing the explosion. And Uber, which is probably the best known name, is the one that all of the tech experts are watching because of what they're doing. I mean, they are raising billions of dollars in capital. This is not a little small thing that's on your phone. Wow. This is something that the tech world sees as a huge opportunity. And we actually have a story on our curbingcars.com website today, an interview with Steve Lohr, my former New York Times colleague, who's looking at what apps mean to the sharing world. And this is literally putting it in everyone's pocket. So in the past, if you didn't take a taxi, you had to know somebody with a car, have the phone number for a car service. And now you just pull out your mobile device, bring up the app, it shows where you are, it shows where a car is, and you can get a vehicle to you in a minute, where in the past you might have to stand on a street corner and wave and hope that somebody would stop for you.
You know, I'm just looking this up because I don't use Uber, but articles say that their value could reach $3.5 billion.
Right. And also, if you remember the BART strike, the one-week strike that went on, that was really the test for Uber and Lyft and the other apps in the Bay Area. And there were some complaints, and we've heard this before, that under great demand, they double their prices. And we also heard that in Toronto, when Toronto had some flooding during the summer, that people were calling Uber because they couldn't take the subway. And Uber was doubling its prices, but it is based on demand and it is based on the number of vehicles that are available where you want to go.
That's incredible. I mean, we have to do a show about this because, you know, friends who take Uber say that it arrives faster than a taxi and it's about $2 cheaper. But again, I know I've talked to these taxi drivers who say I'm working a 10-hour shift and I'm making now between $8 and $10 an hour.
So one of the stories that's gone on out there is at San Francisco International Airport, because Right. Actually, the Uber drivers, I believe, were banned from SFO and are now working their way back in. So you should definitely take a look at that.
Yeah, definitely, because they're getting tickets also at the airport. So, yeah, that's, wow, $3.4 billion. That's incredible. Let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Erica in SoQuil.
SoCal.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think the driving decrease amongst the millennials has a lot to do with economic factors and awareness of all the environmental issues that are happening. I mean, I think that, especially in California, trying to survive on the coast is really expensive. A lot of people are priced out of housing and, in a sense, priced out of cars because they can't find a job to support the lifestyle that their parents had. Also, I think a lot of people have awareness of global warming and have concern with environmental issues that their parents don't necessarily share. And so, they're thinking about their own future and how they can impact that, and combined with the economic factors of maybe just not being able to afford driving. So that's
it. Yeah, thank you. That came up briefly, but Noah, did the environment come up in the interviews you did with young people about cars?
Not so much, but I think that there's something. What I find young people getting excited about, if they are excited about cars, is they do get excited about the electric cars, not because of the environmental impact they can have. And, if you dig far enough down, oh, it's coal fired versus gas. But like, let's not go there. But because of how much less it costs to run a plug-in car than it does to run a gas car. And it didn't hit home for me until I was doing some research and a millennial was telling me, yeah, we don't have to take it in for a transmission change. We don't have to take it in for the oil change. Mm-hmm. With a Tesla, the only thing you wind up having to do, and those are really expensive, you have to change the tires. And that's pretty much the one thing you're going to have to do. And the, price per mile, it's just a lot less. And so there's a nice side effect there in that electric car is arguably better for the environment, but it isn't necessarily where the focus is. It could be something that's just sort of ambiently going on in the back of people's brains, but it's not at the forefront of their, at least for who I've been talking to.
Huh. I wonder, why is that? Because we often hear that that young people are so concerned about the environment, and I'm surprised it didn't come up in your conversations.
Maybe it's taken as a given.
Hmm.
There's a study.
Phineas.
A study from CARE-C where they asked people if they agreed with the statement, I want to protect the environment so I drive less. And people of 18 to 34-year-olds agreed with this statement only about 16 to 18% of the time, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is double what older generations who only agreed with this 9% of the time. So the environment seems to be not the overriding factor, but it is stronger among younger people.
Now, we have an email from Carol who says, in speaking with my son and his friends who are all recently out of college, they cannot even begin to think of buying a car due to the costs involved. My son has an old beat-up car that he repairs himself, and he's always ride-sharing, biking, anything to avoid using the car. Well, thank you for the email, Carol. We've got an email from John who says, when I was 14 to 16, I was working at $4 to $5 an hour jobs and couldn't wait to drive, but gas was less than a dollar per gallon. My son gets $8.50 an hour. Wow, and gas is $4 per gallon or more. That's a difference of 20 to 25% of a dollar per hour wage and 40 to 50% of the dollar per hour wage. My son and his friends just can't afford to even drive somewhere. Thanks for the show. Well, that's interesting, Phineas, because a lot of people are saying it's about money.
Yeah, no, money's definitely part of the story. It's just it can't be the whole story here because the driving boom ended back around 2004, and the economy was still buzzing until about 2008.
We have another question from a listener who wanted to know about privacy in these ride-sharing and bike-sharing programs. He says, enforcing people into these corporatized programs, you're seriously eroding what little privacy that exists in this society. There is no privacy with ride and bike-sharing programs. Let's be frank, he says this is fascism. Mickey, are people concerned about privacy and these ride-sharing programs?
Well, I think that's a little bit, pushing it a little bit too far. And obviously, these are membership programs. And usually when you become a member of something, you give them your private information. So it's not like it's being taken from you without your consent or knowledge. But There are a couple of new programs that are using crowdsourcing information to track traffic, for example, to track tie-ups and that sort of thing. And they promise to scrub your personal information, that they're just interested in the data. I think this is going to become a factor. It isn't a major factor simply because of the membership basis right now. I mean, you're not being coerced. You're being asked, and you actually are paying for membership, so you're giving it over.
And that is Micheline Maynard, who goes by Mickey. She's the editor of Curbing Cars, a new journalism project that looks at changing attitudes toward personal transportation in our daily lives. They're focusing on all of these issues, car sharing, bike sharing, walkable communities. Mickey's a lecturer at the University of Michigan, and she spent 6 years on the staff of the New York Times. Noah Nelson is tech and entertainment reporter for Youth Radio's Turnstile News. He reported for the NPR series Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. And Phineas Baxendahl directs the transportation program for U.S. PIRG, and they just came out with a report that found, thanks to millennials, 16 to 34-year-olds, who are driving a lot less, the driving boom is over. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you fit in this category? Has your relationship with cars changed over the years? Are you taking advantage of all of these car and bike sharing programs? And then the larger question, what changes do you want to see in the future? What changes have you seen in your city when it comes to these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, the budget allocates just 3% for public transportation and highways, but most of that 3% goes toward roads and highways. So how can we shift our priorities? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And let's hear from Georgiana in San Francisco. Hi, Georgiana. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you.
Sure. You're on the air.
So I am 29. I live in downtown San Francisco, and I've transitioned over the past 7 years to having two cars between my husband and myself, and one car.
Georgiana, can you speak up a little, because your cell phone's cutting in and out?
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Much better. Thank you.
To me, I think that the reason that a lot of millennials have phased out cars is that we believe everything that we're being told by science and culture and philosophy, that this is something that we're going to have to do eventually anyway. Living in a really crowded urban area where parking is very, very challenging, I think a lot of people's mindset is, I might as well just start getting used to living my adult life without a car, looking ahead to 20 years down the road, not knowing what the transportation options are going to be.
Right. And are you hearing similar sentiments from your friends?
Yeah, absolutely. Most people, even if they can afford a car, they kind of consider it a hassle or a burden. Maintenance costs, insurance, unforeseen repairs. They'd kind of rather not deal with it. And in an urban area like this, you really don't have to.
And then you talked about 20 years out. I mean, what changes would you like to see?
I think that our transportation budget and our roads have to service the people that are actually using them, and that there's a real lag in terms of allocation of tax dollars and how our political leaders see the roads and the reality of who's using them. I bike down Polk Street and across about half the city every day, and I see lots of people who have small children, people who are carrying large loads, or even young kids who are biking to school by themselves. I think that they're still considered an afterthought and kind of a disturbance on the roads, rather than a population that needs to be accommodated and integrated into how we view urban roadways.
Right. And bicyclists in San Francisco, I mean, across the country, are pushing for more safety, because there was another tragic death last month in Soma. Mm-hmm. A young woman was killed on Folsom Street. And, I mean, that's just, when you're driving down that street, there's so much traffic, so many massive trucks that either don't see you or can't see you. And so that's also a major factor.
It is. The day after that happened, I actually had someone cut me off in exactly the same manner.
Ooh.
And I calmly pulled up to him and said, I don't think you saw what just happened, but you almost just took me out. And he got incredibly angry. Mm. I think that it's kind of natural human psychology, but we like to stereotype. And there's a stereotype among drivers that cyclists are reckless, that we break laws. Well, drivers are reckless and break laws, too. You can't look at someone on a bike and assume that they're combative or not respectful of traffic signals.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big walker, and it's really, it's not easy being a walker in San Francisco, that's for sure. A green does not mean go when you're a walker.
No, it's really scary. I think that there's a fear or a reluctance among drivers to really accept the responsibility they have when they're handling such a large, heavy vehicle. And it means we trend towards ignorance on the issue.
Well, thank you for calling. We've got a number of callers. I'll take a few more, and then we'll get responses. Thanks, Georgiana. Let's go next to Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I think the previous caller really expressed my sentiment. I was just going to call in and sort of stress how important I think it is that we kind of think about reimagining our infrastructure, how roads could be transitioned to include more bike lanes that might make bicycling much more safe. I think that bike sharing programs and bike kiosks are really kind of a gimmick until there's the parking infrastructure for bikes and the lanes that make people feel like they can get to work safely. The cost of owning a bike, I don't think, is really the issue. I think the infrastructure is so oriented to cars that that remains a barrier.
Hmm. Well, thank you for calling in, Mike. On these questions, a new survey just came out from the American Public Transportation Association that showed 74% of respondents supported using tax dollars to create better public transportation. And then we know that there's just huge calls for more bike safety. So, I mean, Mickey, what can people do to try to shift our priorities from so much money spent on highways to more money on transportation and more safety for walkers and bikers?
Well, first of all, we spend money on highways because the federal government is responsible for the highways. But if you look in a lot of communities, there's a tremendous amount going on in individual places for bike safety and for more bike lanes. So Ann Arbor has more bike lanes. Chicago has just put in the first dedicated bike lanes. I am looking at Montreal, which is a place that has coordinated its public transportation, its bike sharing program, and its bike path system. And there are a lot of people that don't even want to ride in traffic. They want bike paths. So Wisconsin is a state that has a bike path system from almost the top of the state down to the Illinois border. And that's something that gets lost in all this because we think about bike paths as a recreational thing, but some of these folks are using them as a commuting tool as well. And so I think what has to happen is on the local level, people in communities, towns, cities have to make it clear to public officials that this is a priority for them and then to obviously elect public officials who agree with that, because so much of this is happening on a city-by-city basis rather than a national initiative.
What are your thoughts on that, Phineas?
Well, I agree with Mickey's comments on it. I think that this is one of these kinds of changes where the whole is really greater than the sum of its parts. You know, if you look just at car sharing or bike sharing or new transit apps or something of that sort, it's important in its own right. But when you put them all together, and some of the callers address this, it just makes it viable, makes it possible to think of not owning a car or not having a car be the anchor of how you get around. It may not just be one option. It may not be that the bus gets you everywhere, but that you've got a whole array of different options that can serve those needs.
We have an email, actually. I'm glad you brought this up, our listener in Berkeley, about marketing and cars. The listener writes, two ways that automakers will try to keep people in their cars is by putting more bells and whistles in cars to make driving fun, and even more importantly, putting engineering students to work on making driving convenient by developing smart cars and smart roads with the aim of cars driving themselves and being able to literally put them bumper to bumper, especially on the highways, instead of creating the kind of public transportation in European cities that will take you anywhere within the city. Mickey, you've looked at this. How are automakers changing because of these, because people are driving less, young people especially?
Well, there's a couple of things that are going on. First of all, as I was saying earlier, the average price of a car is starting to get to record levels. And one of the things that the car makers are realizing is you're not going to get young people in right away, and you're starting to lose boomers and older drivers. So you have to head for the segment with money and which they might be able to sell more bells and whistles to. So one of the ironies of this is that cars might have much more technology and be more expensive, which puts them out of the reach of young consumers. But there's also this new driverless car, or as people call them, self-directed cars, because it's a little spooky to think about nobody at the steering wheel. The whole idea of assisted driving, and Google was way out in front on that. Nissan said today that they're going to have a self-assisted car by the year 2020, and this could be an answer to some congestion issues, but there's an enormous amount of infrastructure, of technology infrastructure, that has to go in to make that possible. And I think there are way more ideas than there probably is money and capability at this point.
Right. And do you agree with that, Noah, based on the conversations you had with young people?
Well, I mean, conversations I had with young people and conversations I got to have with some of the car manufacturers, you know, doing research in this zone, you know, they're working on ad hoc networks between the cars so they can talk to each other, which is a stepping stone towards having some of the self-directed and the sort of smart highway action. But, you know, Sonari and I, as we've been kind of going around in the series, you know, the technology is being put in the high-end cars. You can get a really whiz-bang Audi, for instance, but it's going to set you back quite a bit. If the car manufacturers want to entice the young people in, they're going to have to get that stuff in the lower entry models. They're going to have to take that hit if they want to keep car culture going. And it remains to be seen if they're willing to do that.
What do you mean when you say cars talk to each other?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to get too technical here, but...
I'm just trying to picture what we're going to face in the next 10 or 20 years.
So the idea would be, you know, and you'll even see ads for this now, like smart braking situations. Like if a car, you know, two or three lengths ahead of you, let's say you're driving through on 101 in a fog bank situation. I've done this. I've nearly gone to accidents this way. And someone brakes suddenly and you can't see it. Well, their car is going to send out a signal to the local network and saying, hey, we're having an emergency braking issue. Your car knows that and can signal you.
Wow.
And tell you there's a hazard up ahead, you're going to want to slow down, which is different from the cars purely self-driving at this point, but they can get there to that point. And this idea of an ad hoc network where the machines get to talk to each other is something I was just reading, you know, DARPA's working on that sort of thing for soldiers in the field. So all the components are sort of there and it's being worked on. If they can find a marketing angle to unleash it with, they will do so. But the research is definitely being put in.
Yeah, and do you think that young people will want to take advantage of this?
I think they'll want more take advantage of smart assistant type technologies that they're trying to build in, so that, you know, Siri follows you in your car and your car knows better than you as to like what it is you're trying to do. The whole thesis of the piece we got going this week is that the car manufacturers are trying to make the cars more like smartphones.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you for the email. Barbara in Contra Costa couldn't stay on. She says, I'm 60 years old and I feel guilty when I drive my car. We have another email from a listener who says, the one thing that sadly keeps me from using public transportation, especially BART, is that it's expensive now to go from Oakland to San Francisco, for example. And I only use public transportation when I have to. Cars are still convenient for me. What are your guests' reply? Phineas?
Well, this is, again, a thing where if you've already put in all those thousands of dollars to have a car sitting in your garage, then when you're choosing on a particular trip, it's going to seem a lot cheaper. And this is why things like car sharing and bike sharing, which, you know, might even make it more expensive to take a car for an individual trip, just even the playing field so that you'll choose cars less if you don't already have one in your garage.
Let me jump in on that.
Sure.
This is something we're looking at curbing cars, and that's the idea of what's called driving light. So nobody expects people to give up cars completely, and I'm totally sympathetic with your listener. And I wanted to say that many people are using cars as part of their transportation portfolio. So I know people, a married couple with kids, who have one car for the family. He works from home. She uses the car to get to work. The boys ride their bicycles. You've got people that maybe take the bus during the week. We just had a series of My Transportation Diary on our website. People are welcome to check that out, where folks walk to work, use the bus during the week, and then use the car on the weekends to do errands. Because, you know, let's face it, it's a big country. A lot of things are spaced out pretty far. We don't all have surface rail. We don't all have subways. So, yes, you do use a car. And I am not even saying that the auto industry goes away by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that rather than every trip is behind the wheel, every trip doesn't have to be behind the wheel. You can sort of fold the other types of transportation in with your car.
Well, we don't have time to take our last caller, Janet, but she just wrote in to say that lots of people use multiple modes of transportation. Mm-hmm. It just depends where they need to go and what their situation is. So we've got just a couple minutes left, and I'd love to get your final thoughts about where you think this is all going, because Phineas, in your study from U.S. PIRG, you say that this massive slowdown that we're seeing, again, 16 to 34-year-olds drove a whopping 23% fewer miles on average in 2009 than in 2001, and this is likely to continue for decades. So what's to come?
Well, I think we're likely to see either a future where driving just kind of stagnates instead of becoming more and more, or a future where there's really a more fundamental shift where driving is just becoming less and less important relative to these other modes. And the answer to that will partly be a result of things like technology, but it's mainly going to be a result of what we do in terms of our policy and our public investments.
Right.
So if we're investing in the infrastructure, we'll get that changed ways of getting around.
Best way to increase funding? I mean, what can people do? Other than contact your congressperson?
Demand that there be more investment in more and better public transit and biking and walking infrastructure.
And Noah, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds?
I think we're going to see the car companies do everything they can to try and keep young people in vehicles, and that may include them accepting the fact that car sharing's a big part of that, and they may shift their business models in the long run.
Noah Nelson is a reporter with Youth Radio's TurnstileNews.com. He reported for the NPR series Millennials and the Changing Car Culture. Mickey Maynard is editor of Curbing Cars, a project that looks at changing attitudes toward driving. And Phineas Baxendahl directs the transportation program for U.S. PIRG. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for joining. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. With an ever-changing demographic in the U.S., what does racial justice mean today? On the next Your Call, we'll mark the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom when tens of thousands of non-blacks joined 200,000 African-Americans in D.C. to call for equality and economic justice. How did white allies who marched on that day understand their stake in the civil rights movement? And with so many changes, how has the anti-racist movement evolved? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.